The Wisconsin legislature is about to begin debate of a massive deal to lure Foxconn to the state. Jason Stein has the latest. And now that Reince Priebus's rocky tenure is over at the White House, Craig Gilbert looks back at what was, quite frankly, a very strange 6 months. In Milwaukee, meantime, we remember the civil rights marches here 50 years ago with James Causey and Mary Spicuzza. All that and more today from the best political team in Wisconsin on Politics. Good afternoon. I'm David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics for this Thursday afternoon. Well, we're going to go right away to Jason Stein in Madison to talk about the Foxconn deal, where a debate is about to begin. Here's Jason. So, Jason, Foxconn, the first hearing is today, later on this afternoon. How is this process expected to play out in Madison?
Well, you know, we're looking to see that. I think what the bottom line is, Republicans are expected to pass this up to $3 billion state subsidy bill for the company very quickly, you know, in the coming days. There is still some debate about, do they do the state budget first? Do they do the Foxconn bill first? And that hasn't been totally decided.
Well, didn't the Senate Majority Leader say the other day that he was sort of hoping they could do the budget first?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a power play there. The state Senate Republicans want to get a budget passed that's more along the lines of Governor Walker and his proposal. Assembly Republicans want a little different. You know, they want some differences with Walker on transportation. And obviously, this Foxconn plant could end up in the district of the Assembly Speaker, Robin Voss. So the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, is sort of using this Foxconn bill as a bit of leverage to try and push Voss to pass the budget.
And now it's also possible that the Foxconn bill might sort of change how transportation monies are doled out, right?
Sure, yes. A big thing that's in the Foxconn bill is $252 million in state borrowing to do work on the I-94 segment south of Milwaukee, heading down toward Chicago. That obviously runs through Kenosha and Racine counties, which are seen as the likely locations for this flat-screen television plant that Foxconn has committed to. And then as well, obviously, when you're talking about the level of subsidies that Foxconn is requesting, that could have some impact on the state budget as well, although it's mostly going to be in future budgets.
Is there any sense yet where that money would come from, as you reported with your colleague Patrick Marley the other day, because there really aren't any taxes imposed on a manufacturer anyway? These tax credits would amount to a check written every year to Foxconn. So where would that money come from in the budget?
Right. I mean, these subsidies are referred to as tax credits, but it's important to understand that Foxconn is a company like any other manufacturer in Wisconsin. They would have no or virtually no corporate income taxes or income taxes that they'd be paying. So these credits that they would accumulate would end up getting paid to them in the form of cash. And, you know, I mean, this would come out of the state's main account, and, you know, it's an account that's used to pay for things like health care for the needy, aid to schools and local governments. So obviously, I mean, you know, when you're talking about $200 million a year, to put that in perspective, that is maybe 20% of what, you know, state government would pay to the University of Wisconsin system over that period. So, you know, it's a very significant outlay of cash that's being planned.
So just to be clear, would this have any impact on the current budget that's being discussed in Madison?
It's possible. It would not be a huge impact in the current budget that ends in June 2019. And I should say as well that to receive these payments, Foxconn would need to show that they had actually went out and done things. So they would need to show that they'd paid out money for the plant or equipment, that they paid out money and payroll to workers. So that, you know, this would be a pay upon performance, pay on delivery type model. This would not be a situation where, you know, the state government at least would be paying money up front. Now, the local government subsidies that we have yet to see, those would be in a little different situation.
Right. So what are you hearing around the Capitol from Republicans who represent districts, let's say, outside of either Madison, Milwaukee, or southeastern Wisconsin?
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, there's been, from Republicans anyway, very little criticism of this deal, very positive on it. You know, I will say in some cases, some of the comments have maybe betrayed a lack of a complete understanding of the package. You hear people talking about, well, all we're doing is foregoing taxes we wouldn't have gotten anyway. I'm not sure everyone has realized that these would involve cash payments. Hmm. But, you know, in general, very positive toward the deal and people feeling like, how could we say no to thousands of potential new jobs?
And Jason, one final question. Is this likely today to be the only public hearing before the bill goes to the legislature?
You know, I guess I would be surprised if there is not a hearing of some kind in the Senate. This is not a joint hearing today. It's only a hearing of the Assembly Jobs Committee. This bill probably will in some form go to the Joint Finance Committee, which could possibly have a hearing of its own. You know, that being said, I would expect for this to be passed within, you know, a couple weeks. So it may not be the only opportunity for the public to weigh in, but certainly there's not a long period of time for that. If you have something you want to say about this bill, you know, you probably should say it quickly.
All right, Jason Stein in Madison, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
And now we're going to go to Washington and Craig Gilbert to talk about the exit of Reince Priebus from the White House. Here's Craig Gilbert. Well, Craig, welcome to On Politics. You know, we haven't had a chance to talk about Reince Priebus's exit from the White House last week, and I guess it wasn't really unexpected given what had been going on the last couple of weeks. But what's your take on his time there?
Well, it did certainly feel like it was just a matter of time. You know, he had several things going against him. One, he wasn't, you know, his relationship to Trump, with Trump, was always kind of tenuous. I mean, he came in from the RNC sort of representing the Republican establishment. He had some shaky moments with Trump on the campaign trail, which Trump never forgot, including criticizing him pretty strongly over the Access Hollywood tapes. And at the same time, you know, he was regarded, I think, inaccurately as this Washington insider who brought these vast reservoirs of experience and connections and historical knowledge to the job of White House Chief of Staff. He really was not a Washington insider. He was a party guy who rose up most of that time in Wisconsin through the party apparatus, was a lawyer who practiced in Milwaukee. He'd only been in Washington for about 5 or 6 years and had no real government experience. So even though it was kind of, I think it was a mark against him in a sense that he was perceived as a member of the Washington establishment, he didn't bring to the job the positive attributes of a member of the Washington establishment and a Washington insider, which is that kind of experience, that breadth of experience and relationships that you might have expected from someone who had more extensive government experience.
So he was regarded sort of as the establishment Republican presence in the White House, though. Are there any of those left at the White House these days?
Well, maybe Vice President Pence would be the best kind of remaining example. I mean, the Vice President is an example of a couple of things. He's a movement conservative, and he's also, you know, in some ways a more traditional conservative, and certainly he spent a lot of time in Washington and a member of the political establishment, both as a governor and as a member of Congress. But the ranks have thinned. We've seen so many departures, and so many of them kind of represent either the Republican National Party or something closer to an idea of a Washington insider. So now we have these military figures, and you have the kind of Trumpists, the people that came out of the Trump campaign and signed on with Trump early on. And even as we've seen from Attorney General Jeff Sessions, that even some of those folks are in trouble. So you can't really overstate the degree of turmoil, obviously, that we've seen from this White House. And even though we now have a former Marine general or a retired Marine general as a chief of staff, and who may exercise maybe a tougher chief of staff, certainly, than Reince Priebus, given who the president is, it may not be realistic to expect a dramatic change in the White House.
Any sense of what's next for Reince Priebus at this point?
Well, he could decide to make a lot of money. He's certainly not burning any bridges in the White House. I think most people think that it's been a pretty discouraging experience for him. He was treated pretty badly in some respects, but walking away from it, he kept repeating and restating his sort of loyalty to the Trump White House. That may be one signal. He could run for office. I mean, obviously, there's a Senate race in Wisconsin in 2018, and he has run for office before. That's been a past ambition of his. He may have decided the window is closed on that, but we just don't know yet.
Yeah. And finally, on a related topic, there's some signs that, especially in the Senate, Republicans are now inclined to, at least to some extent, go their own way from the Trump administration, particularly on health care. Trump was tweeting, you need to get back to that. Let's keep going on repealing Obamacare. And the Senate seems to be saying, maybe not. What's going on there?
Yeah, and part, obviously, the fundamental problem, the underlying problem, is that the Republicans don't have a consensus on health care. And they have shown their inability to put a plan together that even their own caucus can support. But beyond that, they have a marginal advantage in a small, very thin majority in the Senate. And a lot of the things that Trump wants to do and is talking about doing, the support is limited. I mean, we just seen now a new immigration plan to cut back on legal immigration. That doesn't appear to have the votes to pass the Senate. Not every Republican senator out there is going to get behind that. Obviously, there's going to be an effort in the Senate to kind of stabilize the healthcare marketplaces, which the president may or may not support. There's bad relations over the president's handling of Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, a former Republican senator. You go down the list of issues, Russia. There's a long list of issues where there is some daylight between President Trump and some varying degree of senators, either whether it's a handful of senators or whether it's something larger than a handful.
All right. Well, Craig, thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
All right.
So now I'm joined in studio with Mary Spacuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and James Causey, a columnist for the Journal Sentinel. James, you've been doing a bunch of reporting on what life is like in Central City, Milwaukee, 50 years on from the civil rights marches. 50 years ago this summer, there was a riot in 1967, followed by something like 200 days of marches for open housing. Talk a little bit about what happened then and what's changed in those years.
Yeah, so I had an opportunity to talk to some NAACP Youth Council members and commandos, people who protected the marchers when they were participating in these 200 days of marches. And what they were marching for is to have the opportunity to live anywhere they wanted to live. And what we find today is that, Milwaukee is still very hyper-segregated, and a lot of people, their children and their children's children have not benefited from those opportunities that they fought so hard for. Mm-hmm. Things have improved, but not to the degree that they expected them to. And unfortunately, I don't see anything happening to really change that, to get more diversity throughout our neighborhoods in this city.
Yeah. You did a big project earlier this year where you looked at members of your third grade class
right.
and what happened to them, and sort of used that as the optics through which you looked at this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in housing, have things changed?
Like I said, not much. I mean, I think what we have is still, because of the lack of job opportunities here, the downturn in manufacturing here has really hurt a lot of young people. And I consider myself still young, but it's hurt a lot of people, and they haven't had the wealth to save her house. Right. And what we find here, even in renting, a lot of people are so, they spend so much more of their income on rent that they can't even save for a down payment to buy a home. And I think what's optimum is like 30%. And what we have here is like more than 55, 60% is going towards rent. And so you can never catch up, because even if you save up enough to buy a home, if something goes bad, you need a new roof or something like that, you can't afford to get that fixed.
Talk a little bit about this project, the 50-year egg, your role in it, what you, what's going to be coming on that in the coming days and weeks.
Oh, yeah, this is fantastic. Tomorrow, I'm going to get an opportunity to talk with one of the oldest commandos, so that should be a treat. But this is a chance to look back at how far we come, talk to people who participated in the marches and the struggles that they had. But it's also an opportunity to look forward, where we're going to have forums, we're going to have meetings in the community, where we're going to have bring some of these members forward. They could talk about their experiences. We're going to also have experts come in and talk about possible solutions. So I want people to stick to it, because it's a lot of stuff to come on this.
All right. Well, thanks, James.
Yeah.
That sounds terrific. We'll be looking for that. Let's move now to our winners and losers for this week. First, Mary, I want to go to you. Who's your loser?
I'm going to go with Chris Christie, who was at Miller Park recently and got into a bit of a tiff with a Cubs fan, where he ended up getting in his face and saying, like, oh, you think you're a big shot. So while the fan probably shouldn't have said, I think he said, you suck, and called him a hypocrite.
It was a Cubs fan, I want to point out.
I was going to point out that I'm used to dealing with obnoxious Cubs fans.
So there you're not surprised by
it's that. Hard to throw a rock and not hit an obnoxious Cubs fan. But no, I feel like if I can have thick enough skin to be surrounded by obnoxious Cubs fans all the time without getting in their face, somebody who's used to being a public figure, who's, you know, the governor of a state, should maybe get some thicker skin. You know, he did recently at a news conference say, like, hey, basically thinking he took the high road because he didn't actually dump his nachos on him, which is kind of funny. But, you know, I don't think either one looked stellar in that exchange. But at the same time, I feel like once you're in public office for long enough, you kind of get used to that not everybody's going to like you.
My daughter ran into him at the Comet Cafe last Sunday.
Oh, really?
Morning. And
she didn't heckle him, did she?
She did not, but others did.
Wow.
So I think he got a lot of that while he was in town. All right, so Chris Christie is your loser. Who's your winner?
Yep. So my winner is going to be the city of Waukesha. The Great Lakes mayors decided to drop or agreed to drop their federal lawsuit against them over the water deal that they've been working on. It sounds like they're instead going to try to negotiate some terms that they're concerned about, but are not going to be duking it out in court. So I think that's a win for the city of Waukesha. That's probably going to dramatically lower their legal fees and clear the way for them to move forward.
Okay, great. Who's your winner, James?
My winner happens to be Milwaukee artists. President Peter Fagan, Bucks president, announced that he's going to showcase 800 pieces of artwork from local artists when the new arena opens. And that's really cool, because Milwaukee artists, they need to be showcased. So that's cool.
Is he good inside the new arena?
Inside the new arena and throughout that whole facility area. Yeah, so it'd be in a practice facility and things like that, too. So
that's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah.
And I saw today, we just had a story by Jim Nelson, that the practice facility is open.
That is awesome. $31 million facility. But not only is it great for the players, the current players, I think it could be like a recruiting tool to bring in top-notch free agents in the future. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Seems pretty posh.
Yeah,
it
is.
It does.
I want to go check it out.
And you get a sense, if you drive by it or walk by it, of what the arena will look like, because they use the same zinc cladding
exactly
on the outside of the practice facility. I drive by it every morning.
Yeah.
So who's your loser of the week?
Oh, it's a lot of losers to pick from. But my loser this week is conservative blogger Tommy Lauren, who was on Politicon. She was on his show Politicon, and she was talking about just bashing Obamacare for like 10 minutes, talking about it was the worst thing ever and how it was bankrupting the country and all these kind of things. And then when she was asked, well, do you have insurance? She said, yes, I'm 24 years old, but luckily for me, I'm still on my parents' insurance until I'm 26. Well, that being on her parents' insurance until she's 26 is essentially Obamacare.
Was because part of Obamacare.
So it was just kind of one of those kind of things like, okay, we get it.
She's made a I mean, it's like not only she's kind of made a living. That's one of the things she's known for is these rants against things like Obamacare, and she's developed this huge viewership, you know, with these long video rants
right.
against him. And
yeah, yeah. I saw her explanation.
Thanks, Obama.
Her explanation on Facebook is that it's not inconsistent to like parts of Obamacare and still hate the overall.
Especially if you benefit from it.
I hear it's easy to come up with an alternative, too.
Not so far. All right, let's take a couple of reader questions. Matt in Milwaukee wonders, is there any political will for some kind of 50-state agreement that would prohibit subsidies being given to either companies, and he's got Foxconn in mind here, or sports franchises like the Bucks? I think he's talking, Mary, about this this bidding war mm-hmm. that occurred over Foxconn, and it's
right.
been fairly frequent over the years. So why can't we just agree not to do that?
Is there a political will to do that? I'm going to guess not. I think that there are, I think that enough governors and enough state lawmakers really want and are concerned about bringing things like jobs and kind of kickstarting the economy, and I think it will be very, very tough for all of them to sign an agreement that they're not going to do it. There are obviously a lot of concerns and a lot of questions about these kind of deals and whether they'll end up benefiting the community or a millionaire more, and I think with something like Foxconn, we're obviously going to be reporting on it and see how this all goes and whether it creates, you know, high-paying jobs that are stick around for the long term. But I think that it would be very tough to get politicians to sign that kind of agreement.
Yeah, they're going to compete. So another question from Angel. What's wrong with giving the individual states control over health care and keeping the federal government out of it? The federal government allocate grants to each state and then let the states do their thing. So, James, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it would come down to political will. I mean, if you have a Republican governor, this 4 years, what happens if a Democrat comes in? Does that change the game? And then I think it'll put certain states at disadvantages, like a poor state like Mississippi. Will it be the same as like a richer state like Minnesota? I don't know. I think that would be hard to do. So
it's similar to what Paul Ryan has recommended in the past, block granting Medicaid mm-hmm. to the states. And some of those same concerns you raised have been raised about this idea of a race to the bottom or inconsistency from one state to another in terms of benefits.
Right,
so
right.
I think that's been the...
And it also seems like each time a new governor comes in, the swing that could occur, like it seems like there would not be a lot of stability if we went to a Dem governor and then a Republican mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. flip-flopped back and forth. Would people's health care just be completely overhauled every 4 years?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So probably, well, no, we don't know.
Yeah.
As Mary pointed out in the previous question, it was hard to get an agreement on Obamacare and Medicaid.
Right.
So we'll see. Well, that's it for this week's show. I want to thank Craig Gilbert, Mary Spacuzza, James Causey, and Jason Stein for being with us. I'm Dave Haynes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for joining us.